Welcome to the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Morgan Gonzalez, a reporter at Behavioral Health Business, your go-to source for behavioral health news and insights. In this episode, I'm talking to Cooper Zelnick, Chief Revenue Officer at Groups Recover Together. Groups Recover Together is an opioid addiction treatment provider that leverages medication-assisted treatment in conjunction with group support meetings to help its members achieve recovery. I sat down with Cooper to talk about Group's approach to value-based care, medication-assisted treatment, and the company's plan for growth. Hi, Cooper. Great to have you on the podcast. Could you start off just by introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your background?
Sure. Great to be here. My name is Cooper Zelnick. I am the Chief Revenue Officer at Groups Recover Together. We are, I think, the largest value-based provider of outpatient addiction treatment in the country. And my background, I'm a person in recovery. I got sober about a decade ago, wanted to join an organization that was helping others in the way that so many people helped me, and have been working at Groups for, oh gosh, almost 8 years now, doing a whole bunch of roles. So that's me.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on the recovery and on the tenure at Groups. So if you don't mind, recap for us how 2023 has, I know we're not quite done yet, but how 2023 has gone for Groups. What were some highlights and what were some challenges?
Look, I think it's been a really challenging year for the industry, right? So one, we serve Medicaid beneficiaries and we deploy modalities that range across in-person and telehealth. And I think for providers of telehealth services, especially those serving Medicaid beneficiaries with SUD, it's been really, really hard. Medicaid redetermination is an enormous challenge faced by, frankly, the entire healthcare ecosystem, not just the substance use disorder industry. And similarly, you know, the ending of the PHE has thrown a little bit of a wrench into the system, although, you know, it's the right thing to do. It's been really challenging. So those have been the struggles. I think with that said, we've had a really great year from the perspective of delivering against our mission. We've grown enormously and expanded access to care into a whole bunch of new states. We've continued signing value-based contracts. We have continued delivering and improving our clinical outcomes. And we feel like we're in a stronger position now than we were at the beginning of the year. We're really excited for the year ahead.
Great. And talk to me a little bit about how Groups responded to those Medicaid redeterminations, how, you know, what preparations were made, and then what that process looked like.
Sure. So the preparation has been the tricky part for everyone, right? I think that we are reliant in many cases on our health plan partners for data. They are reliant in many cases on their state partners for data. And understanding even the magnitude, right? Like, what is the total number of folks who are going to face redetermination? What percent of those folks are eligible but have paperwork to do versus are no longer eligible? What's the timeline? Like, really getting a handle on what is going to happen and being prepared has been a significant challenge. I think the way that we've approached it is, one, we approach it with transparency, and we desperately ask our state partners and our plan partners for help. But two, I think we made a really important decision up front, which was that Medicaid redetermination was not going to be a barrier to care for the folks we serve. So said another way, when folks lose coverage, we default to saying, we will continue delivering services to you at no cost to you as we understand whether we can get you coverage back through Medicaid, whether we need to get you on an exchange plan, whether we need to convert you to self-pay. So there's been no disruption to services for the folks that we serve, which are really vulnerable folks. And I think that's, you know, making that decision has been a really important part of our strategy, because it allows us to operate from a place of, okay, our job is to make sure that we're doing everything we can to help get folks coverage fast, as opposed to a place of like, oh gosh, we have to, you know, refer folks out, or we have to get folks to other providers of care. So that's been kind of the biggest decision we've made.
That's very impressive that you were able to continue care. That's great to hear. Let's shift to talking about value-based care. I know about 97% of groups' revenue, I believe, comes from value-based care contracts, but value-based care can mean a lot of different things. What does it mean at groups?
Yeah, so to us, the way that we define value-based care is a reimbursement methodology that aligns incentives between the three key stakeholders, the plan paying for care, the provider, us delivering that care, and the individuals receiving it. So we have a broad range of contracts, but any contract where our reimbursement is directly tied to either clinical proxies for cost or cost itself is a value-based contract to us. And our goal is to get paid when we, one, people get well, and two, ensure that plans are saving money. If we're doing both those things, we're happy. That's how we think about it.
And how is groups able to set up these contracts with payers?
Well, I think the first reason that we are able to do this, you know, against the backdrop of an industry that really remains predominantly fee-for-service, is we are very focused on delivering great outcomes, and not only on delivering great outcomes, but being transparent about those outcomes with our plan partners and being willing to take risk on those outcomes. So whenever folks ask me about, you know, transitioning their contracts to value or pursuing a value-based care strategy, question one is like, do you have a clinical model that delivers powerful clinical outcomes? And question two is, how willing are you to take economic risk on those outcomes? I'm really grateful that we have a clinical model that delivers real value in terms of clinical outcomes and financial impact, and we take massive risk on our clinical outcomes. Those are the biggest two things to which I would attribute our success.
And once you get these contracts in place, how does value-based care actually impact patients?
I guess it impacts patients in that we are empowered to deliver a set of clinical services that most drive holistic recovery, right? Like, we do not face an incentive to deliver these services which are most lucrative on the fee schedule. By contrast, our job is to deliver the services which help people get well. So I think if you were to ask one of our members, we call our patients members, they wouldn't say, oh, groups is value-based and no one else is. They would say, at groups, I seem to be in a clinical system that prioritizes community and psychosocial modalities and that deprioritizes urine drug screening. By contrast, most other clinical systems don't. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. The actual care is obviously what the members care about, but it positively impacts them through the method you deliver care. Is that sort of right?
That's right.
Perfect. So zooming out a little bit more broadly, what are some of the biggest challenges around value-based care contracting in the behavioral health space at large?
I suppose that the biggest challenge is moving from philosophical alignment with health plans to a structure that meets all of the needs of those plans within a contract, right? So to say, our job is to retain members or patients in care, to deliver engagement, attendance, abstinence, and if we do that, total cost of care will come down based on our internal data and our studies and a whole host of published research that has nothing to do with us. That's non-controversial. Saying to a plan, you know, given that we would like to be incentivized to deliver that set of outcomes, that's non-controversial. The part that's really tricky is meeting the second and third order needs of our plan partners in a way that allows that incentive alignment to kind of carry through to a contract, right? So for example, Medicaid managed care organizations want to reduce total cost of care. They also need encounters to be submitted back to their state partners. It's how their reimbursement is calculated. So how do you create a bundled or value-based contract while also being thoughtful about encounter submission? How do you make sure that, like, we are empowered to deliver care using our integrated care team while also meeting credentialing requirements? How do you translate from outcomes reporting at a strategic level to validating those outcomes in the claims feed? how do you walk the line between being a provider and being a vendor, right? From the perspective of speed and data sharing. I think that's really, really hard. And it requires a huge amount of flexibility and trust and thoughtfulness on both sides. So that is a problem of getting value-based agreements done. I do think, though, that the primary challenge is it's really hard to shift from a fee-for-service methodology to a value-based methodology. We're lucky in that we were born and grew up value-based. So we never had perverse incentives to deliver services that don't drive value. For providers who have been forced to exist off the fee schedule, I think that transitioning to value is really tricky for a whole bunch of reasons.
So how, for some of those initial challenges you were talking about, how did groups get around those? I know that some of the other challenges in terms of switching, y'all were able to avoid, but how did you get over some of the ones you talked about earlier?
Yeah, so the thing that we have done basically is we have a preferred contract structure that allows us to align incentives and get compensated for the value we deliver without taxing the health plan claim systems or data teams or reconciliation teams. So we tend to use a per engaged member per month case rate with massive downside risk, with 75% downside risk tied to clinical proxies for cost that can be validated in the claims feed. So said another way, retention and treatment at 6 months is a great proxy for total cost of care in outpatient substance use disorder treatment. If you can retain patients, you know, for greater than 180 days, you can reduce cost. If you can't, you won't. And what we say is, you know, we're happy to do a upside downside total cost of care deal. But when we are just getting to know a health plan, we like to take risk on our clinical outcomes, specifically retention, which can be validated through the claims feed, right? And by doing that, we are able to create structures that meet the needs of our plan partners and are cognizant of all the other priorities they have, while also empowering us to do great work and aligning incentives.
Great. And value-based care is so widely talked about in the behavioral health space, but is put in practice much less often, partly, you know, because of the challenges you were talking about. What is the future of value-based care for the behavioral health space at large?
Look, I think that holistically, from a trend perspective, we are going to see a continued shift from fee-for-service reimbursement to some form of value-based care, right? Which is to say, reimbursement that pays increasingly for not only the delivery of services, but also the delivery or achievement of outcomes. With that said, I do not think that, you know, quote-unquote value-based care is a panacea. I do not think that 100% of reimbursement should be for value or will be for value. And I think that it's incumbent upon providers to really be thoughtful about, you know, do these set of services reduce cost, right? Because there are certain services that are absolutely essential and critical and great that don't. And then, assuming they do reduce cost, like, how willing am I to take risk on them? And I think, like, we as an industry, especially as a provider industry, spend a lot of time beating up on the payer and saying, well, you know, we want to be value-based and we're so forward-thinking, but the payer's telling us to start fee-for-service and they want to see the data and they're not going to take our word for it, et cetera. And, you know, I don't think that's fair, right? I think that providers, when they say value-based, they often mean, I want 150% of the fee schedule and I want a 3% upside only shared savings, right? And I think, like, part of the reason we've been successful is we don't approach it that way. But the future of this, to me, is like providers being really, really willing to take risk. And I think to, you know, on the payer side, being really willing to share data and be transparent. And I know it's hard, but I think that that's what's needed to get there.
So would you say in the current state of things that the impetus is on providers and not payers to make kind of the first steps towards value-based care?
It's got to be both. It of course has to be both. But I think that, you know, the discourse sometimes is providers are ready and payers are unwilling. And I don't think that's true. I think this needs to be collaborative. I think it needs to happen in tandem. And, you know, what I would say to payers is, like, the big, big problem I see from a payer perspective is a payer says very reasonably, we need to see your data in our claims feed before we will deviate from our fee schedule, right? That's a providers complain about this all the time. You know, the payer says, it sounds great. Maybe you did this with my plan in a different state. Maybe you did this with a different plan in my state, but I need to see it in my data to know if it's worth converting you to value. And I think like my response to that tends to be, well, if you incentivize someone to go in network on a fee-for-service basis for a year or 2 years, and the fee schedule does not adequately compensate for the activities that truly drive value, I think it's unlikely that a provider will be able to do the work to drive the outcomes to convert, right? So there's a little bit of a catch-22 in there. And I think payers have a responsibility to help providers avoid falling into that trap. But I do at the same time think that providers really have to be willing to take risk, and it's a hard thing to do, right? It's a hard thing to do.
Absolutely. Let's pivot a little bit to talk about medication-assisted treatment. I know groups use Suboxone. Do you think that MAT is the future of SUD treatment broadly?
I think that MAT is a critical part of treating substance use disorders and will remain so. And also, I don't think it's the silver bullet. So from a clinical outcomes and data perspective, there is strong evidence that medication-assisted treatment is the best modality we have today for the treatment of opioid use disorder. That's not as clear when it comes to alcohol use disorder. It's not at all clear when it comes to stimulant use disorder. But when it comes to opioid use disorder, yes, MAT, specifically buprenorphine, naloxone, or Suboxone, is the primary tool we have in our tool belt. It's not the only one. I would argue it's only efficacious in combination with psychosocial modalities, but it's a really important one and probably will be for quite some time. With that said, medication alone doesn't solve this problem, right? And I think what we've learned is addiction is kind of, in certain ways, but a symptom of the societal ills that we face. And I think that the answer very broadly is community and connection and medication and contingency management and our outcomes are some of the best in the industry, right? We retain 68% of our members at 6 months. That means that 32% are falling through the cracks. I would argue that's not good enough. And I really hope that more modalities will be developed for the more effective treatment of addiction in the future. So if you're asking if I think MAT is the be-all and end-all and the perfect solution, oh God, no. Do I think it's a really great solution that needs to be more widely adopted? I certainly do.
And in that same vein, do you think abstinence-only approaches to opioid use disorder will become less common? Are they already less common?
Yeah, they are already less common, right? I think there's been wide acceptance that abstinence-only approaches to the treatment of opioid use disorder are really risky. They're not for everyone. And statistically speaking, if you think about someone who goes to a 28-day abstinence-only inpatient program who has opioid use disorder, that individual is more likely to suffer a fatal overdose after treatment than before, right? So those approaches to a degree are being supplanted by or at least augmented with MAT. I think that's right. With that said, do I think that abstinence-only or abstinence-based recovery for opioid use disorder still has a place and is really important and helps a lot of people? I do. And I guess my view is there are a lot of modalities and there really isn't a silver bullet for everyone. Even looking at the data and saying, well, statistically, MAT is the right answer for everyone, it can be misleading because there are a lot of different types of people. And I think as treatment providers, we need to be responsive to the ways in which people are different and use patient-centered approaches to solve this problem.
Thank you. Groups has capitalized on technology to improve access to care for patients. Talk me through some of the challenges that came with implementing those new tech systems.
Oh gosh, where to even begin? I think that technology in and of itself solves a lot of problems or reduces a lot of barriers and creates others. So pre-COVID, in order to get treatment at groups, you had to drive to an office. that was really hard. Some people don't have cars. Other people's cars break down. Sometimes it's snowy. Sometimes there's a tornado. Right? Those are all barriers that kept people from accessing our in-person offices, even despite the fact that we had massive rural presence and still do. Today, with technology, there are any number of barriers, right? Like, are the systems working? How do we integrate our tech stack with legacy EMRs, et cetera? But even moving beyond the internal barriers we face, like, there are folks who didn't have access to transportation who now don't have access to bandwidth. There are folks who didn't have access to a car who now don't have access to a smartphone. And we spend a lot of our time trying to mitigate those barriers. The data that we have is that, you know, embracing technology has net really reduced barriers to accessing care. But again, you know, there are people who today can't complete our intake funnel because they're not sufficiently comfortable using a smartphone app. And I think we have a responsibility to deal with that.
So what tech models or other innovations, maybe less techy innovations, would you think groups would be interested in the future?
The way we think about it is we are at the same time working to improve our tech stack and working to create sort of what we call flexible member journeys for the edge cases where our tech stack actually can't help. And the example I would give is, you know, our technology, our virtual treatment, right, our telehealth treatment allows people who live in more places to engage with more care more quickly than ever before. That is amazing. But core to our mission is serving everyone who has substance use disorder. A big part of fulfilling that mission for us is working with departments of corrections and serving folks who are coming out of incarceration. Those are folks who, one, don't have smartphones in many cases, and two, in certain cases, actually aren't comfortable using those smartphones. So we're working to arm those folks with smartphones and tablets, and we've received grants so we can give those out for free. We're working to help people get access to free or extremely cheap high-speed internet, right? But, you know, that is not the solution or the only solution for everyone, right? Like, how do we use our rural footprint and our local care teams to help folks who can't engage with technology to still get treatment? There are a lot of answers to this question, but I guess my view is that technology has a role to play, but is not the only answer.
Groups currently has locations in 14 states, I believe, plans soon to expand to 4 more. Correct me if I'm wrong.
We're at serving patients in 18 right now and have a path to 26.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Congratulations. That's very exciting. So talk to me about the timeline for these new states and then some of the challenges that come with expanding to a new state.
Oh gosh. So I'll try not to be too detailed here. Expanding into new states is really, really hard. It's the reason why if you think about outpatient addiction treatment providers or addiction treatment providers in general, you know, most of them are regionalized and the industry remains fragmented. There are differing state regulations. There are differing Medicaid regulations. There are differing payer landscapes, not to mention all of the inherent challenges of like going to a new place and hiring and building a brand and developing cultural competency, et cetera, et cetera. So the way it works for us is we select states in a way that I think is pretty intuitive, right? We're looking at need. We're looking at unmet needs. So what's the gap between need and treatment capacity? We're looking at the regulatory landscape, the payer landscape, feasibility. Once we have decided that there's a state that really needs our help and where we think we can have an impact, we pursue our initial real estate. We then have to pursue and receive a license to operate. It's not a business license, like a substance use disorder treatment license. Then we have to get Medicaid enrolled. Then we have to get Medicare enrolled. Then we have to sign the contracts. Again, as we discussed earlier, tricky and time consuming. Only then can we open our doors and begin serving folks, right? And what we've learned is it is critical to be able to accept all forms of insurance when you open your doors. Otherwise, you can't be a really great member of the community, you can't be a really great referral partner, and you can't have the impact you want to have. So that timeline ranges from, call it 18 months to, I don't know, 5-6 years. Licensing and enrollment timelines can be really long. And, you know, it's the biggest thing we do. So what we're thinking about at groups today is not just what are the new states in which we're going to start serving members or patients in 2024. We're actually thinking about what are the new states we're going to start serving members and patients in 2027, and what do we have to do today to get there?
And what does that look like? What are some of the things you have to do today to plan to continue that growth?
Well, I'll give you an example of the state of Georgia, not to pick on them. You know, we decided we wanted to go to Georgia, gosh, 2.5 years ago. We leased an office outside of about 45 minutes outside of Atlanta, and we applied for a substance use disorder treatment license. Getting that license takes about 1.5 years. Once you have it, you then and only then can apply for a Medicaid number. It takes about 270 days. Once you have that, you can sign the contracts. And once you have the contracts and have launched them, you can serve the members. So we are right in the middle of that. And that's all after you've made the decision, right? So that's what we're doing.
Good luck with that.
Thank you. We're getting there.
What's something you wished more people knew about opioid use disorder treatment?
I think the thing that I wish people knew was that the existing modalities of care do really work. I think often, you know, you read the headlines about the opioid epidemic or the drug epidemic, and there's this bent towards hopelessness, right? Overdose deaths are spiking. There isn't enough treatment capacity. People are going to rehab, inpatient rehab, 5 and 10 times again and again and relapsing. And I think it's really easy to get into a place of hopelessness. There are modalities that drive outcomes. If you deliver medication-assisted treatment in a thoughtful, harm reduction-oriented, low barrier way, and you combine that with really robust psychosocial modalities, right? Therapy and community and wraparound services that focuses on health-related social needs, you can drive great outcomes and you can save lives and you can save money. And I think that sometimes we forget that. I wish people understood the value that, you know, great modalities have.
Love that. To close out for my last question, could you outline Group's plan for 2024? What key initiatives and plans for growth would look like?
Sure. So the first thing we are doing is focusing on continuing to execute against our mission. So that is primarily around expanding access to care in the states in which we're already operating, expanding, as we talked about, into new states, continuing to ensure that we can serve everyone who has the disease of substance use disorder. At the same time, we are focused on expanding the modalities that we offer. That is, you know, constantly looking at clinical outcomes and impact to do better for folks who we are already serving, to implement new modalities so we can serve folks we're not serving today, and to be really thoughtful about the needs that our population has above and beyond SUD. And beyond that, you know, we're always really trying to be responsive to our health plan partners and understand what their needs are, where the deficiencies in their network are, and what we can do to help them.
Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Cooper. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That does it for this episode of the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Morgan Gonzalez with AG Media, a WTWH media company. Thank you for listening. Until next time.